is titled What E-Learning 2.0 Means to You with Stephen Downs. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Stephen Downs. When the committee was getting together to work for celebrities, we needed someone who was famous, someone who was smart, and had lots of hair. And so we did a Google search, and we only got two hits. It's kind of unusual for Google, but anyway, the two hits were Stephen Downs and Paris Hilton. And then we checked to see which one was available, and lucky us, it was Stephen that was available, so we're delighted that Stephen is here. I first saw Stephen in action probably in the late 90s when he was doing some work about some learning technology and doing a presentation. It was a video conference like this morning, and we had some technical difficulties there too. And the technical difficulties were that we couldn't get Stephen to stand still in one place because the camera was static. But anyway, at that time he was doing work with Athabasca, and he was probably a leader then as he is now in e-learning and breaking new ground with it. And anyone who knows Stephen has read his OLD daily and his OL weekly knows that he travels a lot, as you can see from his slides. And any of his presentations, past and this one, he'll probably put on his website so he'll have access to all of those. So we really are pleased and delighted that we've got our number one Google hit here, Stephen Downs.
Okay, I'm just going to check and see if my volume's louder than his was, and it is. If you're wondering, this is a piece of free software called Audacity. And what Audacity does is, as you can see, it does audio recordings. And I'll take this audio recording, as I do for my other talks, and put it on my website. The slides and the audio recording will be available at 5:30 this afternoon. And it'll take so long, only because I don't have internet access in here. There is wireless, but I can't break into it for some reason. So, and it's this sort of thing, this sort of capacity, that really is the subject of my talk. And I do have a talk. Didn't have a talk a little while ago, but I do have a talk. And the talk, as you know, was titled, What E-Learning 2.0 Means to You. And you're probably saying, E-learning, what? Because it wasn't particularly clear that it was E-learning 1.0. E-learning 1.0 is the learning management system, the LCMS, the big institutional solution. E-learning 2.0 is what we'll talk about. I want to frame this a little bit, because I believe in frames. With the rest of you watching Elliot Macy this morning, I wonder if I... No, I was trying for feedback there. I always need feedback. So desperate for it before the talk, I was out in the hall glaring at the people going to the other sessions. They glared back. I was thinking about Elliot Macy's talk and all of that, and what struck me was this thought. And it's like Elliot Macy was looking at me and he was looking at Donovan Bailey. And I was asking him, Elliot, because first name basis, so we're not really, I've never met him, but Elliot, what do I need to do? And he looks at me, and he looks at Donovan Bailey, and he says, well, it's obvious, Stephen. What you need to do is, you need to go faster. And yeah, if I want to beat Donovan Bailey in a race, that's how to do it, right? If I want to be successful, velocity, that's the way to go. But observing simply that you need to go faster is really the surface of it. It's a nice, glammy, glitzy surface. It's the Paris Hilton surface. No. For some reason, Paris Hilton has entered into a lot of my talks and just entered into the introduction. I don't know why. Anyhow, what this talk is about, if you look at it, in the context of what Elliot Macy said, is what it means to go faster. Right? Not simply go faster, but how to go faster, and what changes as a result. Because if you look at me and you look at Donovan Bailey, you can tell pretty quickly it's not simply a matter of going faster. Donovan Bailey does a whole bunch of things that I don't do. Like, for example, he trains. I don't. He eats well. I eat pasta. Things like that. So you need to do more than just know where you want to go. You need to have that mindset or that frame in order to know how to do that. This is such an awkward room to talk about. For one thing, the first three rows are virtually empty. Of course, everybody's in the back. So, where do I want to start? I was thinking about where I want to start. And I was thinking, well, okay, let me hear. I'm just curious, how many of you are in the private sector or corporate or e-learning? Rest of your government? Yes? Okay. See, because I've talked and worked with people from the private sector and corporate e-learning quite a bit. And even in the slides that we saw for the Celia presentation, you look at the e-learning marketplace in Canada, and there's a little pie chart. Well, it's a big pie chart on that screen, and you look at where the market was, what products the different companies were offering. The great big chunk was in content, and custom content, e-learning content. And there was another chunk, technology, and a little smallish chunk, services. I forget the exact phrasing of that. And I was sort of looking at it and thinking, that's exactly backwards to what it should be. So I'm thinking, okay, I've got this sort of audience. How do I want to bring this talk about e-learning 2.0 to this sort of audience? And I decided on this way.
And the way I'm trying to phrase it today is, we have, three pictures or three ways of representing, if you will, learning resources or learning content or learning technology or whatever. It's an ontologist's dream. We have learning resources as a thing. And when you're selling content, you're probably into that kind of approach, aren't you? You're thinking of learning resources as analogous to a book or a magazine or a newspaper or a content object or as I referred to as a storm the other day. First time I've seen that. But a thing that you collect, you pile up, that becomes your library, if you will. And that's one way of looking at learning resources. Another way, I was at the Murray Goldberg talk in this room just before this. And the other way of looking at it, it seems to me that this was the picture that he was giving us. And he can correct me, and perfectly willing to be corrected. But learning resources, if you will, as events. And so he's talking about silicon chalk, and you have a class and a software that will take this event and capture it. It will do everything. Imagine Audacity and my slides will do that too. They were free. But again, it's this idea of, I don't want to say learning resources as a thing, because an event isn't really a thing, except in a weird ontological sense. But still, it's something that's in its own way static. It has a start time, has a stop time, it has a very definite location, it has a physical presence. And then there's a third picture, which is the picture that I'm trying to present, which is the idea of learning resources as a flow. Now, I put down their experience. I didn't really have a good analogy from traditional practice to pull over into the idea of learning resources as a flow. So I put experience as a question mark, because that seems kind of right. But usually when I talk about this, I talk in analogies. I talk about learning as though it were electricity, or learning as though it were like water, or any of these other sorts of utilities that just flow and are available. I need power, I plug my computer into the wall, I have power. In the ideal world, I need internet connectivity, I fire up the wireless, I've got internet connectivity. No connectivity here, unfortunately. And when we look at that, the first two depict learning in a particular way. They depict learning in a way that I've come to call an information theoretic model. And I go into a long discussion about that, but I won't at this point. As compared to learning as being something like a network model. I was giving a talk the other day, and this is a bit of an aside, but I can't resist this. And I was asking, why with all of our e-learning technology and all of our pedagogy, do we still do lectures? And because everybody asks that question, I was thinking about that here. There must be a reason for it. I concluded at this talk that the reason why we do it this way, rather than, say, group work or collaboration or some constructivist kind of thing, is if you're sitting in a lecture and you don't like where it's going, you can get up and walk out of the room. You can't do that with the other mechanisms so easily. I say that, I saw a few drifting off. But it all kind of fits together. I know, we're kind of rocky to start, but it'll flow, don't worry. I'm trying to pull some things together here. Let me expand on this a bit. Whoops, too far. The information theoretic view is, in a sense, the view that learning is like, now how do I want to put it? Well, how did I put it? Yeah, I don't like that. Well, I mean, I do like that, but I don't want to say it like that. It's the idea that learning is like language. That learning is like the words in a sentence, where the words in the sentence have a pretty clear and fixed meaning. I say, Paris is the capital of France. We assume everybody knows what I mean by Paris. Everybody knows what I mean by the capital of France. And you can take these little bits, these little nuggets of meaning-laden content and stack them up. You can send them and transfer them around like buses on a road or whatever, from point A to point B. You stack them up, you can deliver them, you can store them, you can prepare them ahead of time. That's the information theoretic picture of learning. The content-based picture of learning. And most of what we do in e-learning, even to this day, is based on that idea. And the essential message that I'm trying to get across here today is that because of the way web technology is changing, this model of knowledge and learning is also changing. And it's changing in some very identifiable ways. And these ways have implications on how you practice e-learning, how you create e-learning technology, how you create and work with e-learning content. That's the talk in a nutshell. Now, that picture that I've just sketched of the information theoretic model can't be true. And it can't be true simply because content isn't the kind of thing that is static and fixed in meaning and truth. Take the word Paris. I've rather joked around with the word Paris a little bit. Everybody think of the word Paris right now. Okay. Have you thought of the word Paris?
No, yes.
Okay. Let's pretend that you thought of the word Paris. How many of you, well, probably a lot, how many of you thought of Paris Hilton? How many of you thought of Paris, France? How many of you thought of Plaster of Paris? If words have unambiguous, context-free meaning, you should all have thought of the same thing. But you've thought of different things. And I can play this with any word that you want. I can pick a word. What is the meaning of is? All right? Because you're coming from different contexts, different backgrounds, have had different experiences, different information environments, before you came to this talk, at the precise instant when I utter the word Paris, you have a different thought from your neighbor. The thought that you have right now is not independent of your other thoughts. And indeed, it is not even independent, necessarily, of the thoughts of your neighbor, or the utterances of your neighbor, or what's going on around you. That's a very different model of knowledge and learning than we're used to dealing with. And it means that we have to approach it from a different technological, a different pedagogical point of view. And is it on the slide? Well, it's on another slide there, again, in Murray Goldberg's talk, I'm talking about the idea of pedagogy-neutral technology. Well, that presumes, doesn't it, that the content of e-learning can somehow be independent of its environment. But what if I say, but if what I say is right, the actual meaning of the content depends in an important way on the environment in which it is presented, which means that it is a conceptual impossibility for there to be a pedagogy-neutral technology. The utilization of a technology inherently influences and in some cases determines, many of the critics of WebCT that I've read say that WebCT over-determines the pedagogy that is used. So what I'm saying embraces the other side of that. We know it's context dependent. We know that what you learn and what you know depends on the network of connections in which you're embedded. What does that mean? So why am I speaking in the microphones? What it means from a hard-edged, in-the-trenches, technological point of view is Web 2.0. Because the web is changing. It's changing under our feet. You think you got a grasp of the web, you think you kind of got a handle of it, you know, the web pages, HTML, maybe instant messaging, ICT, you kind of on that, Skype, yeah, okay, I can handle Skype. The web is changing underfoot. And there's a lot of work, especially in the last few months, that you hardly keep a handle on. I can hardly keep a handle on it. Where what's happening is that the web is shifting from being what might be described as a medium, a place where we store information, a place where we find information, something that we go to read a web page, to consume content, is shifting from that to what is sometimes described as a platform, or as I like to think of it, is becoming an environment. It's shifting from being a medium to a place. Place is not really the right word. It's the only word I can think of at the moment. It's shifting from being something that we consume to something that everybody, not just the people in this room, something that we create. There's some of the, actually, let me slide in there.
Examples of the web as being what we create abound, and some of these things have been talked about already. You've all heard of blogs, right? Okay, looking for the nods. I didn't expect hands. This is not a hand crowd.
Sometimes you can speak to a group of people and yeah, they're anxious to hang around. They're crazy. This group is a quiet, polite nod. Which is fine, except it's kind of hard to see in the back row. Blogging became blogging, not because of the format, not because of the content, not because you could get Trent Watt kicked out of office or anything like that. Blogging became blogging. It became the phenomenon that it is because it put the capacity to create quality web pages very easily into the hands of every single web user, and it did it for free. Podcasting. How many of you have heard of podcasting? Oh, I'll make it hands. Go up here. Podcasting became what it is because it put into the hands of people the capacity to create high-quality audio content and distribute it to a wide audience, all by themselves. You can create your own radio station. And I could go down the list. And it's this shift from being consumer to being producer, or some people talk about prosumers, I don't really like that anymore. The mechanism now by which this happened depends on a certain infrastructure. And that's kind of a rough and ready checklist of the nature of the infrastructure that is being developed. I say being because there are people working on it right now. All of this is in a transition mode. Structured micro-content, distributed data, easy integration, single identity. I'm breezing through that because I'm going to come back to some of that through the rest of the talk. But those are characteristic sorts of things. And the idea here of Web 2.0 is, and again, I keep going back to Murray Goldberg. I don't mean to attack his Murray theories. Oh, I can't believe he didn't come. Well, I can say anything I want about him, man.
No, I'm just kidding.
Talk about integration. The classic of integrated technology, right? It's the learning management system. Everything in a big bundle. And he said, we didn't put blogs into the LMS because there weren't any blogs at the time. Of course, that's not true. There were blogs. My take is they didn't put blogs into WebCT because they couldn't. Because blogs, learning management system, are a different kind of technology. Learning management system is about centralization and control. Blogs are about decentralization and chaos. You look at WebCT, and other learning management systems, they're about an institution providing a service, and of course all of the content, for the student. Blogs are about the student creating all that content, creating all of that service for themselves. So it's a night and day kind of thing. To put blogs into WebCT or into any LMS in a certain way undermines the purpose of the LMS. Now, they've started doing this Blackboard and then have blogs in there now. But there's this tension there, isn't there, between student content and instructor content, chaotic content, formal content. So anyhow, I watched Macy and everybody else this morning. I'm thinking, Macy sort of sees Web 2.0, and he sort of doesn't see Web 2.0. I think he sees more of it than really came across in his talk today, to be fair. The velocity thing. Go back to go back to, I keep wanting to say Ben Johnson, but I can't say Ben Johnson, it's the wrong model. Go back to Donovan Bailey. And the idea here that being dynamic, producing e-learning content in, say, 8 hours, or producing a newspaper on Sunday, isn't simply a matter of going faster. It is rather a matter of understanding what it is that you're producing in a different way. And that way of understanding what you're producing is thinking of the e-learning content, and Macy did say this, as ephemeral, as disposable, as created on the fly, but also drawing from resources from a wide variety of sources. In the world of e-learning, the sorts of sources that we would be looking at are sources like Flickr, which is an online image repository. Sources like blogging websites, sources like personal portfolios, sources like Gmail and other online email services, sources like Skype for voice communication, sources like eBay and Amazon.com for information about good services and products, and a range of other sources which have yet to be invented. There are numerous other eBay or Amazon or Flickr type businesses that have not been invented yet. He talked about ubiquity and scalability, but what these things buy you is not simply the idea that the web reaches everyone. It's not simply the idea that you can get learning content to a person no matter where they happen to be. But also, very importantly, from a Web 2.0 perspective, the idea that you can get learning content from a person wherever they happen to be. This is why I tried to push Murray Goldberg on this a little bit, because he's talking about capturing the experience of a classroom. And I look at the technology, and I look at Web 2.0 functionality, and I'm thinking, why don't we capture the carpenter doing carpentry? Why don't we capture the forester doing forestry? Capture this knowledge at the point of creation, and it being captured by the people who are doing it. And I don't even want to say capture this knowledge, because that's the wrong picture. It's more like capture the image or the experience of seeing somebody do something that expresses that knowledge. That was awkward, I know. But personalization, mobility, same sort of thing. It's the idea of the web belonging to being with and traveling with the person. There's the idea of integration. I do lots of these talks, and I travel a lot from place to place, and yeah, I've noticed most people do. You look out on the road, you see all kinds of people traveling from one place to another. So travel is not unique to me, it's not unique to any of us. But in my own case, I travel basically with what I call, other people call it too, the road warrior kid. And it's a fairly standard kind of setup, but it's the computer,
the mouse, the microphone,
digital video camera, you saw the pictures that I took earlier, internet connectivity, wireless card, that sort of kit. And that sort of kit right now, I have to actually carry in a big suitcase. That sort of kit, over time, gets smaller and smaller, and eventually will all be in their cell phone. Half of it is already. And the idea here is that a person's internet connectivity, a person's online resources travel with them from place to place. It, it's kind of like, I'll be a little Baconian here for a second. Just imagine yourself, you're walking through society, you're walking through the city down Sparks Street or whatever, and there's like this information envelope around you. It's invisible, you can't see it because it's information, right? But it's kind of like your own personal connectivity. And as you go through doing whatever you're doing, you come to a seminar, you go to a Tim Hortons or whatever, your information environment connects with and interacts with whatever the local information environment is. To me, coming from this perspective, it's inconceivable to come in here to do a talk or even to be at a conference and for my internet connectivity to like vanish. Because now it's, I'm in this information vacuum. Even worse, I gave a talk yesterday in a government building across the river, and half the web was blocked. Blogger, blocked. Technoret, blocked. SourceForge, blocked. And it's like they've covered my eyes. They're not letting me interact with the online presence that I interact with. The idea here is that my envelope is personal. It belongs to me. My envelope includes my identity, my name, the location of my website, my email address. All of that belongs to me. It exists independently of any of these institutions that I work with or correspond with. It exists independently of the company that I work for. They would like it not to, but it does. It exists independently of the university I attend. And what happens is my web space interacts with theirs using open APIs, open content formats, so that the messages can be transferred back and forth. Instead of the idea of integrating, creating one single environment in which all of this stuff occurs, you have many, multiple environments that interact back and forth together. And even my web presence, my sphere, if you will, I'm sort of drawing it as this invisible egg around me, but actually it's not around me. My web presence is actually scattered all over the world. Could be anywhere. I keep my images, say, on Flickr, which is in California. I keep my email in Gmail, that runs, which is wherever Google is. I don't know where Google is. I should, but I don't. And so on. So, in fact, my online resources are all distributed. They're out there. They're like independent services, just like universities, just like a company, and they talk to me as well. So what is the picture? You know, there's just something about getting excited sound today. What is the picture of e-learning that is consequent on this? It is not, it doesn't even remotely resemble an application, much less an integrated enterprise suite like an LMS. And Murray's not here, actually. It doesn't resemble silicon chalk either. So I'm glad he sold it. He got some money out of it. That makes me happy. The picture, part one. All of these things are small bits and pieces. Okay, wow. But it's kind of like rock bands. But you know rock bands, right? You know, they're separate, but they're connected. And, you know, you have Dylan, he has his career, and he goes to travel and Billberries, and but the whole point here is, it looks like this. Here's a service, or a content, or whatever. Here's a service, or a content, or whatever. Here's a service, or a content, or whatever. Here's me. Here's my university. Here's the government. Here's the police division. And they're all separate. They all run in their own way. They all do their own thing. And yet they all communicate together. Now, it's not just software that does that. Content itself does that. We talked a bit about, newspapers, how newspapers are put together. Imagine the newspaper in your mind, but when you picture the newspaper in your mind, don't imagine it as a physical object in front of you. Rather, imagine it from the perspective of the origin of all of the content in that newspaper, in both space and time. And what you get is your newspaper is actually composed of content distributed from around the world that was brought together. And content created 10 minutes ago, a week ago, a year ago, all brought in. In a newspaper, we actually have to bring it all in physically and print it on a piece of paper. On the internet, because we have this connectivity, we don't have to move it from where it is. It can be where it is. And when we see the newspaper, all of that content is still where it is. But from our perspective, it's right here in front of us. It's like that. Now, the picture that I'm describing applies not only to applications, it applies to content as well. I've tried to express this in metadata. Think about what we know about a person. Think about what you know about somebody you may know reasonably well, a relative, an employee, or whatever. The information, your knowledge of that person is not derived from a single place, and indeed is not stored in a single place. If you're going to hire somebody, you would not depend strictly and solely on their CV or on their resume. You would be insane to do so. Actually, you'd probably hire a whole bunch of bad employees. Information about a person is stored all over the place. It's stored in the university in the form of transcripts. It's stored in the police station in the form of a criminal record or a driver's license. It's stored in the credit bureau. It's stored in the insurance bureau. It's stored, at the CIA, wherever. And this knowledge is brought together. And this knowledge does not exist independently of other knowledge. As you can see from this slide here, this knowledge actually forms part of a knowledge ontology. You might have information about, say, a resource, and then you have information about a person. You have information about a company. You have information about a financial agent or a rights dealer. And all of this information is kept separately, but it's connected together. You sort of see the picture I'm trying to draw here?
Try pulling this off with an LMS. So here's the bit about the person. I sometimes anticipate my slides. I'm sorry about that.
This concept I represent under the heading or the rubric of resource profiles. And basically any information can be described under this rubric. And in this rubric, there are basically different types of data that describe a given resource, a given piece of knowledge, a given person, a given company, whatever. There's three types. First type, first-person data, or as I somehow also call it, first-person metadata, is bibliographical data. Data created by the person who created the resource. Name, if it's a person, birthday, things like that. Second-party data, or second-party metadata, is data created by the user or direct interactor of the resource. If it's a book, for example, second-party data would be the fact that somebody bought the book. It would be what that person thought of the book, a book review. It would be the price of the book as offered by a bookseller. And then third-party data is information about the resource created by an uninterested or arm's-length third party. Cisco and Ebert's review of the book. The censor board's decision to approve or not approve the book. The Library of Congress's classification of the book. Do you see that knowledge of the book actually exists in all kinds of places? All of our knowledge is like that. All of it. Think about the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from London to New York. Or wherever. I just picked two cities. I was going to say Paris, but I decided not to go there. Ask yourself, who knows how to do this? How do you get a 747 from London to New York? It turns out no one person knows how to do this. The knowledge, the actual knowledge, is distributed across a large number of people. Some people know how to manufacture airplane tires. Other people know how to create and install windshields. Other people design navigation systems. In the flying of the plane, one person knows how to do the navigating, the other person knows how to land the thing without crashing it. And yet another person knows how to distribute coffee to the passengers without spilling it on them. This knowledge is distributed across a bunch of people. The knowledge itself exists in no particular place. So what we've got, think about this. We've got a mechanism, we've got a picture of knowledge, a picture of learning, and a picture of technology, and I would argue, for those of you who are politically inclined, a picture of society which is distributed, where the resources are scattered in a large number of places, and that knowledge consists of a pulling together or an aggregation of those resources at a given time, from a given place, from a certain point of view.
I tried to do tried to write up this talk before today. But you can't write this talk before today because Elliot Macy hasn't spoken yet, Murray Goldberg hasn't spoken yet. And so I don't know what the content would be. It has to be pulled together, brought together at the time and place of need. That's why it becomes a dynamic system. That's why you're looking at 8-hour turnaround time to create e-learning. So the mechanism to make this happen is to create and understand these networks, these systems of interaction ahead of time. To know how, for example, you're going to get that news article from Reuters. To know how, for example, you're going to get that criminal record information from the police station when you're looking at a new hire. To know how, for example, you're going to get instructions on landing assemblies for 747s to show to your new mechanic. Here's the picture as it looks like right now to people who are working on e-learning 2.0. They don't all call it e-learning 2.0. George Siemens calls it connectivism, for example. This diagram is by Scott Wilson. He's just called it Future VLE. Instead of your learning management system, you have a personal learning environment. Your personal learning environment is part of that information age that covers it. It's yours. It's you. It belongs to you. Your personal environment connects to all the other resources, all the other services that are out there. Flickr for photographs, 43 things for to-do lists, what else have we got? LearnDirect for learning resources, LiveJournal for blog posts, the University of Alberta for stuff on petroleum engineering, McGill University for political science. If some people are interested in both,
see, the picture we have right now with the ETL and that's all. It's provider-centered, right? It's content-centered, it's product-centered, and provider-centered. A person signs up to your university, your corporate thing, or whatever, and enters your environment, at which point they are in your control. Web 2.0 turns that upside down, where the provider backs out of the picture, and the person becomes the center of the picture. It's a personal environment, not a provider-centric environment. There are still providers, but you interface to them through commonly accepted and very often application-specific APIs or XML languages, known collectively as microformats. Take a look at this picture again. You can't see it, but you see these little lines here, and there's a little bit of writing on between these lines. Each one of these lines is an already existing API or XML format. A lot of this infrastructure is already in place. FOAM, friend of a friend, for personal information. RSS, rich site summary, or really simple syndication for blog content, newspaper content, and some other sorts of content. Dublin Core for academic articles and things like that. And more, there are many more. And like I say, you can't read them. On the original laptop, you can read them.
You have a multitude of these little formats. Those of you who are in e-learning have worked on IMS specifications and SCORM, everybody's going, standardize, standardize, standardize. This picture is, don't standardize. What you're trying to do is create a connection between A and B. Create a format specific to A to B. Microformats. Google Maps API. This conference, I went to this conference website, had a little embedded map, which is kind of cool, and even moved around a bit, but the way to do it is to access the Google Maps API so that what you have in the conference website is actually an instance of Google Maps. Why Google Maps? Because I can get to it from anywhere in the world. It's something that I already understand and that I already use. I'm already interfacing with it in other applications. I can zoom it all the way out, zoom it in. I can use another program out there to actually draw a little route from where I live to this place. If I'm driving, if I'm flying to the party.
Flickr API, specific to Flickr photographs. And the idea of the Flickr API, you use the Flickr API, you can embed photographs on a completely unrelated web page. Skype API. You've written a neat application. You'd like to offer real-time voice communication with someone else. You don't build one of those from scratch. You tap into the Skype API. Your application leverages Skype. And now you have provided two-way voice communication in your application for the cost of interfacing with an API. And when you create a service, a map service, a content service, a communication service, you create it not closed, not locked down, but rather open. You expose APIs and data formats to the world so that other people out there can hook into your service and bring your content or your service right into the environment. This is a bit of an aside for the techies. A lot of people talk about this and they talk about SOAP, Simple Object Access Protocol. None of this stuff is being done with SOAP. SOAP is like buying a battleship when you needed a rowboat. Most of this stuff is being done, if they have to do it complicatedly, they're using REST, representative state transfer. Usually, it's something as simple as an HTTP GET request. Simple technology. End of the cycle. What does it look like? Think about your learning environment again. User-generated content, personalized content, opinionated content. It always comes from a point of view.
It's a network of interactions. It's blogs, it's photographs, it's audio feeds, it's flash animations, it's whatever people can think of to create. It's people creating with tools that you provide for them. Because you're not making stuff for them anymore. You are making stuff that lets them make stuff. And that's the big difference. It's thinking of not just blogs, but all content, learning contents, images, etc., as structured data that can be moved from one application, one site, from one place to another. And then it's the mechanisms, the systems for pulling this together, just the way your daily newspaper does every Sunday, pulling this all together and presenting it in a single place, but a personalized place. Did I do two again? Yeah, I don't want it to run. It's also a world of new kinds of roles, new kinds of ways of looking at things, because we're not dealing now with big stacks of content or things that can be hoarded or anything like that anymore. It's like we've gone from handling ice cubes to moving to handling a raging river. And the sorts of roles and tasks of the future are more like riding these rapids, more like trying to understand this information flow and interpret it for people, rather than trying to sell it, if that makes any sense. That's a bad analogy, but I tried. Robin Good explains this nicely when he talks about the concept of the newsmaster. And indeed, those of you who are familiar with my own online presence, which I describe as explicitly as a type of e-learning, is that sort of role where I see, and newsmasters in general would see, the information from a given domain, a given subject area. I specialize in e-learning. And they look at that, and they bring it together, organize it, filter it, and then feed it forward as a new specialized information flow. And this sort of model is something that we're going to see replicated in large number in the future. Blogs already are sort of like ways of doing that. But as this becomes more of a professional thing, we will see trainers of the future, educators of the future, becoming more like newsmasters than news presenters. More like people who identify, highlight, filter, feed forward, comment upon resources that they see, rather than being an information or a content generator or presenter. It becomes more like managing a flow than selling an object. I've talked about podcasts, Flickr, Wikipedia. How many of you are familiar with Wikipedia? Yeah, most of you. Again, it's the same concept, isn't it? It used to be the case where we had a company that would provide us a service in the form of an encyclopedia, and we would pay thousands of dollars for it, and it would come in 24 volumes and occupy half the living room wall. Today, we, that is the users of the web collectively, have created the encyclopedia for ourselves. And it's not only bigger, it's more used, it's arguably as accurate, it's certainly more current. It's changing the model from a company creates an encyclopedia for us to we have the tools now to create our own encyclopedia. And the next step for Wikipedia, and if you're building educational technology, you ask yourself how you're going to do this, is getting Wikipedia integrated into educational applications so that if you are, say, writing an essay in a Word document and you need to look something up, you just right-click and the appropriate Wikipedia article pops up. That kind of thing. Or I picture this with RSS and Wikipedia, and that you're working on a project and you're typing it up or whatever, and in a sidebar, your system is tapping into this network. As you type, it looks at what you're typing and it suggests or recommends resources for you.
Search is so 2000. We should be thinking about systems that know what you want and are sufficiently well connected to the rest of the web to be able to find it and present it to you. Not present it to you the way spam is presented to you, but present it to you in a well understood, controlled way through the network of intermediaries and filters. So that if you're typing up your thing, the things that are presented to you are only those things you've already read or your friends have read and recommended. Content syndication, I talked about it a bit, there's a fancy little diagram that explains what it means. But again, this content syndication is the glue that holds this together. It's not just content syndication, of course. It's content, it's people, it's services, it's companies. It's anything that can be represented with information can be syndicated and brought together in a single environment. Right now, RSS is the dominant form. Atom is an up-and-coming form. But of course, you know, there's a large number of syndication formats. And again, the picture here, the information's all out there. You have an informational need here, whether it be teaching, whether it be finding your way to the conference, whether it be having a brown cow. And the idea is that your systems are already set up and connected so that when you need that information, that syndication network is sufficiently tapped in to produce it for you. Learning is a network phenomenon in this picture. It's not you versus the content. It's not even you in a small group working on some project. It's you being immersed in this network, part of this network, connected to this network. It's the web as an environment. The web is a space, a place where you're living. My knowledge, as I sometimes joke to people, half of my brain is on my computer. In a sense, that's literally true. It would be very messy, but you know what I mean. But also, and George Siemens expresses this probably better than I do, half of my knowledge, probably more than half of my knowledge, in a situation like this, is actually in your hands. And if I needed to know something, I'd be asking you. And even as I give this talk, I'm understanding what I'm saying, whether what I'm saying makes sense, through the interactions with you, as I see your nods or as I see people leaving the room and discuss this. My knowledge of my own talk resides to a certain degree in you. And that's how you have to structure your software. If you are building your software has to be mostly out there and only partially in here. Sometimes people say the way you should build software these days is try to do one thing really, really well and then make sure it's networked to everything else. And I would never, ever try to build, at this point in time, anything like an enterprise system of any sort. The most ambitious thing I would build is that personal learning environment. And even then, most of the personal learning environment is out there somewhere. If this is the picture, then how do you tell a successful initiative or what could be a successful initiative from what is not likely to be? I've identified three major success factors, if you will. That's business speak, and I'm not good with business speak, so just calling them that. First thing, embrace diversity. Because diversity is what allows for personalization. It is what allows for choice. It is what allows for flexibility. It is what allows for, if you will, the competition in the marketplace that lets the best solution float forward. The second, connect and interact. Connect and interact. If whatever you build cannot connect with something else, it's broken. And then third, and I talked about this a lot in other forums, is openness. Open standards so that you, your application, can know what other applications, how they're speaking, so that other applications can know how to get data from your applications. open content, because it's not about owning the content, it's not even about producing the content anymore, it's about helping people produce content. And so we need an open content environment, open source, so that you can know how these things interact with each other, so that there are no deep dark mysteries, so that big parts of your network can't suddenly go dark because of changes in licensing or changes in format. Those, it seems to me, are the three major factors. And just as a teaser to wrap up, I think that these are success factors not merely for educational technology, not merely for pedagogy, but indeed for a much wider range of things, including governance and political philosophy in an increasingly interconnected and networked world. That's my talk. That's where it will be. Thank you very much. I love it when he says 2 minutes left and then I'm on my last slide.
Thank you, Stephen. You delivered as promised, and we made a good choice in inviting you, and we're delighted to have you here. It amazes me, and I'm sure it amazes many other people, how much Stephen knows. He just seems so knowledgeable. But the other part is how he takes on these difficult analogies to explain things to us, which is a sign of a teacher, and we appreciate that, Stephen. On behalf of the committee, thank you for being presenter today.
Thank you.